The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You know what time it is. It's time for Ask a Spaceman. I'm your host, Paul Sutter. You've got questions, and I've got the answers. You know how this show works, but let's run through it one more time for the good old days. All right, you go online to Twitter or Facebook, use the hashtag Ask a Spaceman, all one word, otherwise like the hashtag thing doesn't work. You send some questions my way. I'll look for them. I'll pick them out. I'll answer them on the show. If you're not the Twitter or Facebook kind of person, that's cool. You can go to the website, askaspaceman.com. There you'll find some juicy show notes too. You can also email askaspaceman@gmail.com, or you can also find the show on YouTube, youtube.com/c/askaspaceman. That's the thing. Or just type in Ask a Spaceman and look for my face. My face looks like this. And if you don't know what my face looks like, well, then you're out of luck. But you can go to pmsutter.com. That's my own personal website. It has all my outreach stuff, all my shows, all the good stuff that you want. And we have a very simple goal with this show. I mean, it's so easy. A baby could say it. If babies could talk, they would say, we want complete knowledge of time and space. It's going to take a while, but this is only episode 27. So, you know, we're making our way there. You know, maybe by episode like 5,000, we might get a little bit closer. So we got a while to go. So on the way to complete knowledge of time and space, we have so many questions. Oh my gosh. So last week, I'm recording this, by the way, on February 14th, 2016. I don't usually give the date when I record, but this time it's important so you understand why I'm picking this topic. Just last week, a scientific collaboration called LIGO announced that they discovered or detected gravitational waves. And so there were a flood of questions. And I thought, you know what? I've been meaning to do an episode on general relativity any day now anyway. I've just kind of been putting it off because, you know, that's how my life is. But I figured it was a good time. You know, it's in the news. You know, by the time this publishes, it will be like totally old news and nobody will care anymore. But it's a hot topic right now. So tons of questions. Might as well go through them all. And there's so many questions. Even questions from before. People were already asking me about general relativity and gravitational waves before this big announcement. Then I just got a flood. So we got people like @Skatata on Twitter asking, could you explain general relativity? How did Einstein figure it out? We've got Scott Monty on email saying gravitational waves. How does this affect our view of the universe? We've got Ray Culver asking on email, just gravitational waves in general, nothing too specific there. We got Michael McLaughlin on Facebook, gravitational waves. How could they tell, they being LIGO, how could they tell it was two black holes colliding and not something else? What will we actually get to detect? We've got Bear Badger. If that is your real name, I salute you. That is a top-notch name. That's way better than my name, Paul Matt Sutter. By the way, if you want to follow me on Twitter or Facebook, it's Paul Matt Sutter. You can follow Bear Badger too if you feel like following someone with a way better name than mine. Anyway, Bear Badger, he asked, is gravity really a force? Saul Hirschman asked, what's the speed of gravity? At Chuck Han asked, what the heck is gravity? What are Newton's and Einstein's laws? Peter Ellinger over email, how do gravitational waves work? Emilio, why is the acceleration provided by gravity different to the acceleration provided by like a rocket or something? We've got @CroftAndy just asking about the curvature of space and what exactly does it mean for space and time to be curved? I'm not really comprehending that. Also, a bunch of you are asking about this comet I made. No, not comet. Comment. Comets are things that go around the sun. A comment I made kind of in passing, half as a joke, where I talked about the expansion of the universe and how it's expanding faster than the speed of light. But no, that's not really a problem. And you shouldn't worry so much about it. Some of you are still worried about it. So I thought I would put that in this episode because it's all about general relativity. I'm going to pass on that. I don't want this episode to run too long. So we'll get on. Don't worry. I'll do a special or something about the universe expanding faster than the speed of light. So all you people who asked about that, hold tight and keep listening to the show and keep giving me 5-star reviews on iTunes while you're waiting. That would be super helpful. Anyway, so let's just get on to this general relativity business. What is going on in Einstein's brain in the early 20th century? Now, he had already revolutionized the world of physics, at least, with this notion of the theory of special relativity. And I did like a whole episode. I did 2 episodes on it. Man, that's how impressive special relativity was, is I needed 2 whole episodes to dig through it. So I suggest you do a little bit of homework and you go back and listen to those episodes, kind of get a little refresher before we make the jump from special relativity to a little bit more general relativity. But I'll give you the lowdown. Special relativity starts with the principle of relativity. It was this idea floating around at the time where all the laws of physics, you write down a law of physics. You know, it could be the law of gravity. It could be laws describing electricity, magnetism, heat transfer, just whatever. You write down a law of physics. And the principle of relativity says that all these laws of physics essentially must be the same in what we call, quote unquote, inertial frames. The quote unquote just goes around the inertial, the frame doesn't get a quote, it's its own word, inertial. It's a little bit of a physics word. Just toss that out that, you know, you're at a party. I like to give you tips for when you're at parties to help you be more sociable. And by giving you some astronomy words and physics words, one of these is the word inertial. Just saying, hey, how was your day? You can respond, my day was quite inertial. Just give it a shot. I don't know if it'll work. It probably won't. So you shouldn't take my advice. I don't know why you're listening to a physics and astronomy podcast for social advice anyway, but that's your problem. Anyway, inertial basically means you're not accelerating or decelerating. You're either standing still or you're just coasting along. You're just cruising. You're an inertial frame, in an inertial frame. And the principle of relativity says that all the laws of physics that we can write down ought to be the same in any inertial frame, any frame of reference where you're just cruising along. For example, Maxwell's equations are that predict the constant speed of light. If the speed of light is constant in one frame of reference, going one speed, cruising along, it ought to be the same in every frame of reference. It was this kind of thinking that led Einstein to develop special relativity. And in order to develop special relativity, in order to kind of build the mathematical framework to get the job done, he had to unite space and time into a single fabric. And he didn't even like actually kind of realize that he was doing it. It was other people like Hermann Minkowski, who pointed out like, oh, by the way, Einstein, when you develop the special theory of relativity, you actually united space and time into a single framework. Isn't that cool? And Einstein didn't even call it the theory of special relativity. He probably called it Einstein's theory. I don't know. That's what, if I came up with a new theory, you know, it's Paul Matt Sutter's theory right off the bat. I'm not giving it some silly name. Anyway, Einstein, he wrote down this theory, and there was another physicist, Max Planck, who read it and said, Einstein, this is so awesome. And it relies so much on this principle of relativity, this idea that all the forces or the laws of physics ought to be the same in inertial frames. This is such a cornerstone of your theory that we should just name it after that. So I'll just name it the theory of special relativity. And Einstein's like, yeah, cool, that's chill, whatever. So we had special relativity, which the push for that, for Einstein to come up with that, was from the theory of electromagnetism developed by Maxwell. But we still had Newton hanging around. We still had Newton's law of gravity developed hundreds of years ago, super old school, super old timey. Newton's law of gravity was not compatible with Einstein's notions of special relativity. Right? Special relativity was made to work with Maxwell's electromagnetism. But now Einstein has a problem because, you know, there's this other force of nature called gravity, and special relativity is supposed to apply to everyone all the time, all the forces. And I don't have a way to describe gravity that works with all my special relativity business shenanigans goings on. So that's like the pickle that Einstein put himself in after he had developed special relativity in 1905. So to do the job, Einstein had to take this special principle of relativity and the special theory of relativity and take it to the next level. He had to go up a notch. He had to turn it to 11. Instead of just all laws of physics being the same in all inertial frames, all frames of reference where you're just cruising along coasting, let's go all the way, man. Let's make all laws of physics the same everywhere, all the time, no matter what. You're accelerating, you're decelerating, you're not moving at all, you're cruising along, doesn't matter. You're twisting around, you're turning, you're flipping upside down, doesn't matter. Laws of physics ought to be the same. So where does this take you? Where is this idea of a little bit more general principle of relativity, hint, hint, where does this take you? So let's see where it takes us. It takes us on a rocket ship. Let's say you're on a rocket. You're just in space. You got a fancy rocket ship. You're blasting along. And you're on like the bottom, the floor of the ship. So you drop a ball. Like you're holding a ball and you let go of it. What does it do? Does it float there? No, you're in a rocket ship. From your perspective, it looks like the ball falls to the floor. If I were standing outside of the rocket ship and I was like peeking through the windows, it looks like, because you're up in space, it looks like you let go of the ball kind of just stays there, and the whole rocket ship moves. That's what it looks like to me outside, right? It's like the floor of the rocket ship is coming up to meet the ball. But you, inside the rocket ship, you can't tell that. It just looks like the ball falls to the floor. It's the same thing for the Earth. It's like if you stand on the Earth and you drop a ball, it looks like the ball falls to the ground. So if you were to close the windows on that rocket ship, totally seal it, and let's say we put you to sleep. This is like a really twisted, sick experiment. We put you to sleep, and when you wake up, you're either going to be on the Earth or you're going to be in a rocket ship that's accelerating the same 1G acceleration, like 9.8 meters per second squared. So the same acceleration that the Earth gives you through gravity, that's how hard we're going to push this rocket. And when you wake up, you don't know, am I in the Earth? Am I in the rocket? So you decide to do some experiments, right? You start jumping up and down. You start throwing balls around, doing whatever. Whatever you can think of, you can't find a difference. Right? You let go of a ball, the ball falls to the floor. Are you on the Earth? Is that because of gravity pulling that ball? Or is it because you're in that rocket ship and the rocket is moving up to meet the ball that's kind of hanging out in midair? You can't tell the difference. So there's no difference. There is no difference. And this is something that Einstein stated from this principle of relativity, where he said all the laws of physics are the same. He made the next jump, which is there's no such thing as a difference between gravity here on Earth, the force of gravity of the Earth pulling down balls and stuff, to being in a rocket ship at the same acceleration. no difference at all. This is called the equivalence principle, and it is the cornerstone of general relativity. This is where it all hangs together. The equivalence principle is saying that inertial mass is the same as gravitational mass. Now, here's more words for you. I know, don't worry, calm down. Inertial mass is like how much oomph it takes to move something. Like if you're a heavy book, it takes a certain amount of oomph to get you going, right? And if you're a big giant building, and if I want to move you, it takes a lot more oomph. You've got more inertial mass. Gravitational mass is like how strongly you react to gravity, right? If the earth is pulling on me and I have more mass, it pulls on me a little bit harder. And if I have less mass, the gravity of the earth pulls on me a little bit weaker. These two ideas of mass don't have to be the same. And in fact, in order for like Newton's laws to work, we assume they're the same. And then Einstein elevated this and just said straight up, they are the same. That our two conceptions of mass, inertial mass and gravitational mass, how much oomph it takes me to get going and how strongly gravity affects me are the exact same thing. They are equivalent. And you can tell they're equivalent by running this rocket ship thought experiment. Because in a rocket ship with rockets blasting under my feet or sitting here on the earth and feeling like the earth is pulling me down, I can't tell the difference. The laws of physics are the same in both instances. Now, here's where it starts to get weird. Imagine you're in this rocket ship. You're blasting off, doing whatever, cruising in space. You're accelerating, so you're always getting faster and faster and faster. And you've got two windows. Now we've opened up the windows. Ha ha, you're on a rocket ship. Surprise. Let's say a bit of light comes in one window. Bing. Okay, just light comes in the window. And it's inside, like, inside the cabin of the rocket ship for a second. I don't know. You've got a really big rocket ship. Where is that bit of light going to leave the rocket ship? Is it going to be at the same level? Well, no, because the bit of light comes in the rocket ship, and then during that 1 second, while that light is making its way across the rocket ship moves. It's accelerating. It's like, it moves forward. So when the light leaves, it's not going to be leave through a window that's at the same height or the same position in the rocket ship. It's going to be a little bit lower, isn't it? It enters kind of through the nose of the rocket ship, through the tip, through one end, and it comes out through the tail end, through a side on at the bottom of the rocket ship, right? Simply because the amount of time it took for that light to cross the rocket ship moved forward a little. Not, you know, you can draw some pictures or whatever to figure this out. So, to you, sitting inside the rocket ship, it looks like the path of light was curved. It comes in through that top window, and it looks like it's bending down in order to get out that lower window. That's what's happening from your perspective. Same way, you drop a ball, it looks like the ball is falling to the ground. A bit of light comes in one window and it looks like it goes out another window. It looks like the path of light is curved. And according to the equivalence principle, if it happens inside an accelerating rocket ship, it happens around the Earth. If it looks like the path of light is bent, going in one side of a rocket ship and coming out another, because of the acceleration of the rocket ship, then the path of light is bent around any gravitational source. The path of light is bent around the Earth. The path of light is bent around the sun, around any star, around a galaxy, around a cluster of galaxies. Gravity bends the path of light. That is a prediction of general relativity that you get from this idea of the equivalence principle, that the laws of physics are the same everywhere. And in order to describe it, because it looks like the path of light is curving, you need the language of curvature to mathematically describe that. And the natural place to do it is that space-time, that fabric of space-time. It looks like stuff is getting curved. So you take that space-time and you allow it to bend and curve. This is the thought process that led Einstein to get to general relativity. And so in the simple picture of GR, in the like one sentence summary of how general relativity works, is that stuff like you or me or anything with energy or pressure or shear or anything bends space-time underneath it. And that bending of space-time influences the motion of stuff. The actual description of general relativity is a set of 10 very complicated interlocking mathematical equations that are fiendishly difficult to solve. But that's a math problem and not the subject of this episode. And the cool thing about general relativity is you can work this one way or the other. On one side of all the math equations, you have the actual bending and curving of space-time. And on the other side, you have all the stuff, just the listing of how much stuff is where. And stuff could be mass, energy, it could be pressure, it could be shear, all sorts of things. And you can ask, okay, if I have this arrangement of stuff, say I've got a star, how does that bend space-time? And then you work it through, okay, if it bends space-time like so, how does that influence the motion of something else, like a planet? And I should point out, by the way, that Einstein wasn't the only one at this time heading in the direction of general relativity. This was his thought process for building up his theory of general relativity. But there were other people, especially like David Hilbert, who was a mathematician, who had already known about special relativity, because that was published in 1905, and he was also working towards general relativity. In fact, he came up with a totally different way of getting to the solution, the equations of general relativity. He's thinking about it from a completely different angle, a completely different perspective, came up with the same set of equations, and he actually published his paper shortly before Einstein did. And in fact, today, when you're a physics student and you're learning about general relativity and how to actually derive it from fundamental principles, you tend to follow in textbooks David Hilbert's approach. It's a little bit more mathematically coherent than Einstein's approach. Einstein was a little bit, not sloppy, I shouldn't say sloppy, but like he mixed in some intuition about the physical world with some math, whereas Hilbert's development was like pure mathematics, but that's a whole other show. Anyway, just wanted to toss that in. So you have a little bit of trivia at your social gatherings. And there are so many cool solutions to general relativity. It's by examining these set of equations that gives us black holes, that gives us the evolution of the large-scale structure of the universe, that gives us the bending of space-time, that gives us the bending of light around sources, gravitational lenses, and it's what gives us gravitational waves. But before I get to waves, I want to talk about, there's this question, is gravity really a force? Well, in the picture of general relativity, gravity is kind of a fiction. It's not really a force. It's not like you and me are sitting across from each other and we're like bouncing things off of each other that connect us through gravity. It's not like that. It's one thing bends space-time, and the other is just cruising along, moving. In fact, in general relativity, everybody is on an inertial path, a non-accelerating path, but the world underneath you gets bent and twisted and curved. So even though you're cruising along with no acceleration, you run into a dimple or a dent, and your path gets changed. Or you speed up or slow down because of the ground underneath you, and it looks like acceleration. It looks like a force, but it's not really a force the way we would think of a force. It's It's this fundamental aspect of space-time that we're all responding to, and that's a little bit different. So instead of so general relativity takes this fundamental idea of special relativity, where space-time is our background stage that we all get to play on, and that background stage obeys certain special rules. General relativity elevates that stage to be like a thing. It's not just in the background, it's playing a part. In fact, it's probably the star of the show, where you're not trying to live your life on like a wooden floor or solid ground. You're trying to live your life on a trampoline. And if there's like something heavy in the trampoline, and you would prefer to just move across the trampoline in a straight line because you're not really a fan of trampolines and you're kind of over this and you just want to go in a straight line, but then there's a big heavy thing right in the center and you try to go in a straight line, but your path gets curved because it's the ground underneath you is bending and you can't help but go in a curved line, even though you're trying to go in a straight line. That's the world of general relativity. And it means if you're on a trampoline and that heavy thing starts moving around, maybe that heavy thing starts bouncing up and down or spinning around or something. The rest of the trampoline is gonna feel it, right? I mean, if you've got, say, a bowling ball or like something really heavy, I don't know, heavy things, and you drop it in the middle of a trampoline, the trampoline starts wiggling. And if you're on that, you're going to feel it. You're not just going to stay in one place. You're going to bounce up and down. You're going to twist left and right. It's just like water waves, right? If I'm standing in the water in a pool and you're standing on the other end and you squirted me with water and it really ticks me off and I want to get back at you, but I can't reach you because I'm not the best swimmer. You're out of arm's length. I can slap the water. I can slap it. And it'll make waves, waves of water. Those waves will travel away from me. And then the waves will slap you in the face. The waves of water do the slapping for me. They let me slap you from a distance. And these waves aren't carrying stuff. It's not like a water molecule that's near me ends up slapping you in the face. The water molecules actually stay pretty much in the same place. They just wiggle up and down or left and right. So waves don't carry stuff. They carry energy. I slap the water near me. Those water molecules push the ones next to them, which push the ones next to them, next to them, next to them, next to them, and into your face, which is what I wanted in the first place. A water wave is a wave made of water, hence the definition. A gravitational wave is a wave made of gravity. And gravity is bending of space-time, so a gravitational wave is a wave made of the bending and flexing of space-time. Right? Because if space and time can be this funky, wiggly thing that can bend and curve, it can wave. Just like water, the surface of water can bend and curve, and it can wave. And if I can transfer energy from one spot to another using water waves, I can do it with gravitational waves. Just like if you're at the beach and you've got water waves crashing onto the beach, that's because there's a distant storm over the horizon or winds far away, half an ocean away, that are kicking up the waves, pounding at the water, transferring energy to that water, making the waves. The waves travel both through space and through time, right? If you stay in one spot, you'll bob up and down. And if you take a picture of the wave, you'll see it stretching, you know, from horizon to horizon. Waves travel, they move in both space and time. And they eventually reach the beach. Gravitational waves are bending of space and time. They're actually flexing time and they're actually flexing space. So that literally means, straight up, when a gravitational wave passes over you, your clocks will run slower than faster, slower than faster, slower than faster. You will literally squeeze and then stretch and then squeeze and then stretch. Space and time underneath you, through you, are being deformed, are being changed, and you're responding to that. And if you're wondering how, like, how does the wave actually do that? It's because it's waving space-time, and changing space-time is exactly what gravity is. What we think of as the force of gravity is really, in the general relativity picture, the bending of space and time underneath us. And if you wiggle that, if you change that, then you are making gravity happen. So it's almost like a superpower. You know, in like comic book movies or whatever, there's like a bad guy or something, and he like waves his hand and the good guy like gets slapped or gets pushed back. That's a gravitational wave. I mean, really weak one, but you know, a gravitational wave nonetheless. You are massive, not very massive, but you know, you have some weight. We all do. You move around. You are, just like you're slapping water waves, you are perturbing space-time underneath you. And these perturbations, these wiggles, propagate away from you. They just like water waves would, they move away from you, carry a little bit of energy with them. And if someone's far away, they might get squeezed or stretched a little, or their clocks might run a little slow or a little fast. You transfer energy from one spot to another in the form of a wave by deforming, by changing, by curving space-time underneath you. You can influence stuff on the other side of the universe. The thing is, it's like super weak. All right, gravity is already the weakest of the four forces of nature. And it takes a lot to make a wave. And that's kind of why it took forever to find waves. This collaboration, the LIGO collaboration, which stands for Laser Interferometer Gravity Wave Observatory. So really, I think it should be LIGWO, L-I-G-W-O. But I guess they thought LIGO sounded cooler, so they dropped the wave out of the acronym. I'm not in charge of acronyms, by the way. I never am. It took them like almost 25 years to dig out a gravitational wave. We've known about gravitational waves for quite some time. In fact, the 1993 Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded to some people who found gravitational waves. But what they're looking at were two neutron stars orbiting each other. And they noticed that the neutron stars were slowly, ever so slowly, getting closer to each other. The only way they could get closer to each other, I mean, if you're in orbit, you're just in orbit, right? In Newton's laws, you're in orbit, you're stuck, you're done. That's all you get. But in general relativity, when these two heavy things are orbiting each other super fast, they're releasing energy. They're wiggling. They're slapping space-time underneath them. That takes some energy out. And because they lose energy, their orbits get closer and closer. And we actually observe that. And the only way to model, to explain how exactly quickly these neutron stars were getting closer to each other was if gravitational waves existed. It was the only thing that fit. So they got a Nobel Prize. Congratulations. But still, we hadn't directly seen gravitational waves until this past week. And the LIGO collaboration announced that they saw, quote unquote saw, two black holes merging together. Now, where do they get this? So what they're doing is they have giant lasers. Easy way to describe it. Just giant lasers. If you have giant lasers, you can do gravity wave experiments. And they're looking for these tiny changes in space-time between these two mirrors that are like 4 kilometers apart, right? Gravitational waves are super weak. Otherwise, we kind of would have noticed by now. We'd be walking down the street and be shorter and taller and shorter and taller, and our clocks would be all screwed up. It's a super, super weak phenomena. Even from the strongest sources, even from super massive black holes doing their thing, the gravitational waves produced are really weak. So they're looking for tiny differences, and they had to go after upgrade after upgrade after upgrade to their instrument in order to get the sensitivity needed to look for these tiny little changes. But you might ask, like, okay, so you've got two mirrors, you're bouncing these lasers back and forth, they start wiggling back and forth. It could be because, I don't know, maybe a train ran over the ground above one of your detectors. You know, or maybe someone dropped a pile of books, you know, next to your detector. Wouldn't that make the little mirrors vibrate? And you might think, oh, I have gravity waves. But no, you don't, because you really just detected someone dropping their books. Any tiny little vibration in the experiment will make these mirrors wiggle around a little bit. And you might think you have gravitational waves. But what they saw was very specific. It wasn't just any ordinary wiggling around of the mirrors. They saw what they call a chirp, where the mirrors are flexing back and forth because space-time between them is flexing back and forth. And the black holes that they're claiming to observe, and that they did observe, when the black holes start orbiting each other, they start coalescing, they start to merge. At first, they kind of send out slow, very wide waves because they're pretty far apart. But when they get closer, they start getting more intense and they start really pounding gravity. They start really pounding space-time underneath them until they merge together. And then they ring a little bit, you know, and then they settle down into a single normal black hole. So they start out like womp, 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 womp. And then as they get closer, womp, 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 womp. And then right before they merge, it's like womp, 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 because they're orbiting super fast, like over half the speed of light around each other. And then blah, they merge together. All this happens in like less than a second, because that's how awesome it is. And so it's a very unique fingerprint. It's not any normal vibration. It looks very specific. This pattern of the way the mirrors in the LIGO detector are wiggling back and forth from these gravitational waves are very specific. Like, there's nothing else that looks like that. But it took them a long time to get the sensitivity to get down to the scale where they could measure very accurately these super, super tiny changes in the position of the mirrors. Once they did that, they got chirp, they got a signal. I think even the LIGO team, they weren't even done with their like test runs when they started getting signals. Like, they're just playing around, you know, like still tightening up the screws, you know, and stuff. And then chirp, they're like, wait, wait, no, we're not ready. We're not ready. But, you know, they were ready and they could publish it. And they got a few more chirps after that. That's what took so long, was building a sensitive enough instrument that they could detect it. Now that they have the sensitivity, they're seeing chirps all over the place. Turns out black holes merge all the time, which we kind of knew already, but it's nice to see them. And that's the cool thing about LIGO and the future of gravitational wave astronomy, is we're seeing stuff that we've never seen before. Black holes, for example, are rather dark, hence their name. And when they merge, there's not like a boom, there's not a sizzle, there's not a flash of light, right? By the time they get down to that point where they're about to merge, pretty much all the gas that normally surrounds a black hole and is like hanging on as part of a black hole posse or something is usually torn away or sucked in. And so when black holes merge, it's all dark. We're not going to see it. We're not going to see like a flash of light when black holes merge, but we will hear a chirp. Or we'll see these mirrors wiggle back and forth in a certain pattern. And that pattern, if you turn it into sound, sounds like a chirp. Like, yep, something like that. That was a really bad impression. But that's all you're going to get. So it's like, with the future of gravitational wave astronomy, we get to see stuff we don't normally get to see. We just see black holes merging together. We get to see neutron stars getting sucked into black holes. We might see some leftover patterns from the very early universe, right? We get access to some of the most extreme physics in the universe that don't have any like visible counterpart. There's no light given off. There's no emission, at least easy emission. They might be obscured or hidden. But gravitational waves, they don't care. They'll just pass on through. You got a cloud of dust in the way, who cares? Gravitational waves don't, that's for sure. It's like having a new sense, a new way of perceiving the world around you, where the sky is loaded with gravitational wave information. Think of all the stuff happening in the universe. It's a pretty busy place. All that stuff is ringing space-time, pounding it over here, knocking it over there, scratching it down here. And all those waves, all those wiggles, all those ripples in space-time make their way at the speed of light, make their way to Earth, and they wash over us. Right now, look at your finger. Your finger is getting slightly smaller and wider, and then long and skinny, and then short and wide, and then long and skinny and short and wide. Oh, all the time. From these gravitational waves, from the fabric of space-time underneath you and through you, flexing. Now, you don't normally feel it. That's why we need like super expensive and super sensitive experiments to see it, to detect it. But now that we can look for them. We can spot them. We can look for black holes merging in a way we would never be able to see before. We can look for distant echoes from the most early moments in our universe that we would never be able to detect before. It's a new window into the sky. It's a new way of doing astronomy. So I'd like to thank my Patreon contributors. And if you'd like to join their lofty ranks, you can go to patreon.com/PM Sutter. P as in Paul, M as in Matt, Sutter as in Sutter. My top contributors I thank on the show because you are just so awesome. Helgi Bjorkog, Tim Fever, and Anne Bolin, a.k.a. Jessica Candle. Thank you for being my top contributors on Patreon this month. And you should join them because I would love to thank you and sing your praises on my little show. Also, you should check out my other shows, realspacepodcast.com, and on YouTube, Space in Your Face. So much fun, so little time. I'd like to thank everyone who flooded my emails, my Facebook, my Twitters, my all overs with questions about gravitational waves. Thank you for being so curious about the universe. And thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about the universe. One of my favorite subjects bores my family to death, but it doesn't bore you, which is why I'm talking to you right now and not my family. Keep those questions coming. Remember, hashtag Ask a Spaceman. You can also please follow me directly on Twitter and Facebook. Sometimes if there's a question or someone says something and I don't want to devote like a full half hour to it, I'll write up a Facebook post or I'll put a few tweets just to get that information out there. I love communicating with you guys. You're an awesome, super interactive audience. Couldn't ask for a better audience. But you can follow me Facebook and Twitter, Paul Matt Sutter. It's like the PM Sutter, but fully spelled out. So I'll see you next time for complete knowledge of time and space.